That's how the light gets in.
Welcome to Gnosecast, the Gnostic podcast, with the Reverend Troy Pierce, where questions make heretics. Views expressed in this podcast are those of the speaker.
Ring a bell, let's still ring.
Episode 2, Holy Smoke Without a Filter. Greetings, I'm the Reverend Troy Pierce, and this is the second episode of Gnosecast, the Gnostic podcast. This episode will follow the same general format of the last episode, consisting of four sections. In the first, we will look at the religious assumptions and framework that we bring to Gnosticism. In the second, we will see that to be a Gnostic, one must be an agnostic. And in the third, we continue our exploration of how our current understanding of religion was formulated as a result of the growth of Christian Orthodoxy. And lastly, we look at the important question, what is I? Thank you for downloading and listening to this podcast, and let us begin. Last episode, I introduced myself and gave a brief sketch of the process of formation I underwent to become a Gnostic priest and to serve as clergy in the Ecclesia Gnostica. The form of the Ecclesia Gnostica is that of the one holy, universal, apostolic church, tis to say, that of historical Christianity. If one were to approach it as such, one would miss the point. One of the first things, and one of the most important things, we must do when we come to Gnosticism is to examine our religious assumptions. And more importantly, to examine the framework that those assumptions are a part of. Very few people come to Gnosticism without any previous framework involving religion. Those very few people were raised Gnostics. And even then, at some point, they must go through and examine their religious assumptions. Because the understanding of religion one is raised with must always be scrutinized at some point. Paul wrote famously, "When I was a child, I understood as a child, and I spake as a child. Now that I am grown, I have put away childish things." Very often when we look at our world, we see people who have not put away childish things, whose understanding of religion has, in its essence, remained unchanged from their childhood, whose image of God is simply that of a parent, and often a very abusive parent at that, and who has never thought critically about any of their beliefs or assumptions involved with religion. They've essentially been indoctrinated into one set of beliefs. And far too often we find that even after they discard the beliefs or particular beliefs They keep the framework that those beliefs were part of and replace the previous beliefs with other beliefs, keeping that framework intact. Examples are far, far too common. So many times when someone leaves a manipulative, abusive group, which we colloquially usually refer to as cults, often they will only deny some part of the doctrine of the cult. They may perhaps decide that the individual was not the one they claim to be, however, that all the belief systems and all the doctrine and everything else was true. They simply became undeceived about the cult leader and remain firmly enmeshed in the worldview that that leader created. The danger with the odd surge of popularity of some ideas associated with Gnosticism is that these ideas will simply be incorporated and the framework that they held before will simply continue. While it is true that a Gnostic fundamentalist is an oxymoron, inconceivable that someone could understand Gnosis and still be absolutely certain about information, it is very possible to be a fundamentalist about Gnostic ideas. Other very common problems arise from clinging to a particular aspect of a previous structure. Most religious structures are much more authoritarian about aspects of one's life and about information, and whether it is conceivable or possible to disagree about such issues and function together otherwise without a problem. Another aspect where people bring their assumptions from other contexts is that of responsibility. Many people see some kind of clergy, laity divide, as if we were not all in this together, attempting to accomplish the same thing. Others think that if there is a clergy, that somehow is oppressive to the laity, rather than just letting them off the hook, as others seem to think. But that is simply a limitation of their assumptions. Ministry is for all. All you need is gnosis and humility, and you can serve. You don't need the form of a church structure. You don't need any particular form. And the forms can be very small, very minimal, very brief and transitory. Simply helping someone out, doing some volunteer work, listening to someone, giving someone your attention, turning your consciousness to them, is a deep form of ministry. Someone does not already do that, then why dress them up and have them prance about behind an altar? Makes no sense. It is merely an idea, an assumption, that is a block or an excuse, or generally, both. Others bring to Gnosticism some fairly specific assumptions, such as that there shouldn't be a priesthood because they hold the assumption from Protestantism of the priesthood of all believers. However, if you want to devalue something, the easiest way to do that is to make everyone that, and it then becomes meaningless. As we see in Protestant churches, they may not have priests, but now they have ministers and pastors and such things as that. There has to be some level of leadership and guidance, And if it is a liturgical form of worship, there must be a period of formation and transformation. And if there is any instruction or teaching involved, there must be education involved. And I think the most important thing for anyone to even think of pursuing ordination is to have a vocation. For without that, you absolutely have nothing to fall back upon. And trust me, it isn't what you think. If you haven't attempted to serve as clergy, you may not have no idea, but you have very little idea of what it is like. Other religious ideas that people bring are their ontological and theological ideas. Their notion that when one speaks of God, one is speaking of some particular image of God, or that these words imply beingness, some physical existence, if not material existence, of a particular form out there somewhere, rather than representing forms through which we invoke and evoke the presence of the divine. Often people bring a great deal of baggage with the concept of God and feel as though the Gnostic concept of the demiurge is blasphemous. And if you're holding that rigid of a concept of God, then there should be a lot of blasphemy involved, because it's a concept, it's an idol that you're holding in your head. It's not God. Demiurge is a false image, a false idol. It is whatever claims to be God. Sometimes it is ourselves, part of ourselves. Times it is an image, an idea. Other times, something more. But if we merely come with our assumptions, our ideas, and our images from previous religious background, we're going to miss all of that. Furthermore, if you come to our services with only assumptions that come from a background from previous experience and understandings of Christian liturgical practice, then you will miss what is going on. You will not be open to experience and see what is in front of your face. For as the Gospel of Thomas says, if you see what is before your face, there is nothing that will not be revealed to you. But if we cannot see what is before our face, because we are squishing it through various sieves and filters, then it won't be revealed to us. We will only see what we are prepared to see. If we come to a Gnostic Eucharist and are only willing to see a form that we may have had some bad history with, as it strikes us as looking a bit like pre-Vatican II Roman Catholicism, and there is no possibility of gnosis in it for us. We can't see it. We can't experience it. How could there possibly be gnosis? And so we must begin examining our religious assumptions before we can hope to understand or follow a Gnostic path. And in this, I've only covered assumptions associated with, broadly speaking, Christianity. But let's not let off the hook assumptions associated with Buddhism or neo-paganism. No matter what similarities we may see, there are differences. And no matter what our understanding may be, it is at best our current understanding. It's not absolute truth, unless you've decided to declare yourself to possess some sort of infallibility, in which case, there are probably medications that will help. So, I would encourage everyone, particularly when beginning the path, but also whenever you are making a change in the path, and especially, oh, most especially, when considering undergoing formation as clergy, so that you do not simply try to be a slightly more Gnostic version of whatever it is you were before. I've seen this happen too often. To be a Gnostic means to seek Gnosis, not to seek to have our ideas and prejudices fulfilled through our filters and expectations. So sift, look, see. See what is before your face, and there is nothing that will not be revealed to you. Seek, and you will find. For it is the truth that will set you free. It is the true experience of things that leads you to Gnosis, that leads you to that truth. The truth is not in your mind. The truth is not in your concepts or ideas. And most certainly, the truth is not in your prejudices. Seek it. Find it. Become free.
Well, I could just go on and on. But tonight, I've got a headache.
Arise and remember, for you are those who have heard my call. Follow your route, which is I, the Compassionate One, and guard yourself against the angels of poverty and the demons of chaos, and all those who ensnare you. Beware of the deep sleep and the enclosure of the inside of the underworld. From the Apocryphon of John.
And everybody knows that you're in trouble. Everybody knows what you've been through. From the bloody cross on top of Calvary. Everybody knows it's coming upon. Take one last look at this sacred heart before it blows. And everybody knows. Everybody knows.
Last time, we looked at the counterintuitive notion that being a Gnostic means not knowing almost everything. We began to develop a Gnostic epistemology, that is to say, began to develop an understanding of knowledge that includes gnosis, that includes a distinct category of knowledge that comes from and leads to experience, acquaintance with, recognition of, rather than the simple mental storing of information. This time, we'd like to look at two words and two concepts that are in one sense opposites, but are in another sense correlatives. When one describes oneself as a Gnostic, it is common to be misheard as saying that one is agnostic. And the three general ways of approaching the claims of religion are atheist, theist, and agnostic. A theist is one who approaches religious claims with the assumption of the existence of a particular form of God. The atheist is one who approaches religious claims with the assumption that there does not exist any God. And the agnostic is one who approaches religious claims without an assumption of knowing one way or the other. In Greek, there is the privative alpha. And so the way to show the opposite of something is to have an alpha or an A in front of it. So we have theists and atheists. Those who hold to the existence of a God and those who reject the existence of God. And we can see this privative alpha at work in the difference between being a Gnostic and being agnostic. In Greek, the two are opposites. To be a type of knower and one who does not know in that way. Yet to put human beings into such categories is rather odd, unless we are speaking of knowing or not knowing a particular thing. To be a knower in general, to be a not knower in general, implies being either a know-it-all or being a know-nothing at all. And, of course, that's simply absurd. To become a Gnostic, one must first realize and become an agnostic. Realize that one does not know so much, in the sense that one does not possess gnosis. And to be a Gnostic does not mean that one is a possessor of gnosis about all things. It means one is still, largely, agnostic. And it is a process, a path. One must attain gnosis. And it cannot be done simply, quickly, through easy-to-follow instructions or some other nonsense. As we looked at previously, if one simply comes to Gnosticism with the same framework, the same God images, the same assumptions, then there isn't anything particularly Gnostic about it. You are not experiencing what is there. You are merely seeing what you wish to see. You are merely seeing what your assumptions, backgrounds, filters, ideas have prepared you to see. And there is no gnosis in that. And so to follow a Gnostic path, and to realize the difference between what we know, what we have gnosis of, and what we do not have gnosis of, we must go through a phase of being an agnostic, and be willing to remain, to a large extent, an agnostic. If you mistake a fact, a conclusion, or an idea for gnosis, and you then come across information that shows that that fact is incorrect, that conclusion is faulty, or that was a complete misunderstanding, then you're in a very odd position of having your gnosis contradicted and becoming either a defender of it and risk becoming something of a Gnostic fundamentalist, or run the risk of throwing out everything, including real gnosis. A truly Gnostic attitude accepts that we're going to be wrong about a lot of our ideas and understandings. And furthermore, that these things are not themselves gnosis. To have a Gnostic attitude, a Gnostic epistemology, an understanding of knowledge that includes gnosis, is to be willing to not be absolutely certain about things that are not gnosis itself. And gnosis itself cannot be conveyed directly from one person to another. So there is always room for misunderstanding, both within ourselves and between people, about these things. Now, to jump to the extreme, but all too frequent and, frankly, not fun at all, rhetorical game that's played constantly, and to assume that that implies that there can be no sharing of insights or understandings of gnosis, is to illustrate the point that one should always be an agnostic, because such is not implied at all. Scientists hold the possibility that their experiments might not show what they desperately hope that they show. And if they don't, then they're not functioning as very good scientists. And it is that way with Gnostics. If we do not hold out the possibility that what we understand might not be a bit off, that our information might be incorrect, if we do not hold the possibility that our understanding may not be a complete understanding, or that our gnosis is not complete gnosis, or make the mistake that gnosis is simply information about things that are not directly perceived, then what is Gnostic about it? Without being agnostic, you simply cannot be a Gnostic. There is no room for gnosis to occur. There is no room for an understanding to grow. There is no room for the play of ideas to occur, for the play of myths, of stories, for the experience of symbols. If you are not an agnostic, you cannot be a Gnostic. It is just as Lao Tse wrote in the Tao Te Ching, that it is the empty space in a bowl that makes it useful. A block is not a bowl. You cannot put anything into a solid block. A bowl has room. You can put things inside it. Becoming agnostic is a way of making room, of allowing space, of making a container for these things to occur and for gnosis to grow. So this is very, very important. If you have certainty about all your information, there's no room for gnosis at all. Clear away the rubbish. We all have so much of it in our minds. Don't be afraid. Do some serious spring cleaning at any point of the year and at any point in one's life, but particularly beginning the path. But when shall I sing hymns to you? It is impossible to grasp your hour or time. But for what should I sing hymns to you? For the things that you have created, or for the things which you have not created? For the things which you have made visible, or for the things which you have hidden? But why should I sing hymns to you? Because I am my own master? Because I possess something of my own? Because I am another from you? No. For you are what I always am. You are what I always do. You are what I always say. You are all, and there is nothing else. What is not, you are. You are all that has become. You are all that has not become. You are now understanding, and you have understanding. You are now Father, Creator. You are now God, and are active. You are good, and create all things. From the Corpus Semiticum.
We are building a religion. We are building it bigger. We are widening the corridor and adding more lanes. We are building a religion, a limited edition. We are now accepting callers for the pendant keychains. To resist it is useless. It is useless to resist it. His cigarette is burning.
Last time we began to look at the question, is sane religion an oxymoron? And we looked at how a simplistic view of religion as either all good or as all bad is just that, very simplistic. We also began to look at the common understanding of religion as being identical to holding a set of beliefs. And we followed that to its logical conclusion that indeed, if religion does consist of holding a set of beliefs, then sane religion is an oxymoron. However, we spent most of the time looking at where this notion of religion as belief came from through the development of Christian orthodoxy. Now, it is important that when we look at the development of Christian orthodoxy, we do not merely adopt a very simplistic view there either. It is in the nature of developing an orthodoxy that one must define what is and is not a part of it. And we should be careful with simply adopting the definitions that an orthodoxy makes of that which it rejects. To tell a simple story is to grossly oversimplify. Furthermore, if we accept the understanding of Gnosticism provided by folks such as Irenaeus Solon, then we have bought into the story of orthodoxy. However, to think that we cannot see some unifying element among those rejected elements simply because of a story told by those developing orthodoxy is to take that notion to such an extreme that it becomes a fallacy. So let us take a bit of a deeper look at what is involved in constructing an orthodoxy to give us further insight into how this has shaped our current understanding of religion, so that we can then begin to turn our attention to understanding the limitations of that view and of that framework, so that we can begin to free ourselves from viewing Gnosticism through the filters created to describe and circumscribe orthodoxy. As people who live in what has been dubbed the information age, we are aware that information is something that can be readily transmitted, stored, retrieved, passed on. And so information is a very egalitarian form of knowledge. Often our very egalitarian notion of information misleads us into thinking that possessing information is understanding it. Or that if two individuals possess the same information, they possess the same understanding. The ease in which information can be conveyed, compared, lends itself to this misunderstanding. And so we can see this as being a part of the process in the formation of orthodoxy. If you want to have a uniformity across areas, across individuals, the way to seek that uniformity is through information. Are the teachings the same? Are the scriptures the same? Are the beliefs the same? And so we see very early on, across the diversity of early Christianity, the growing interest in that which can be communicated, that which can be agreed upon, and that is information. And this information is phrased in the form of belief, because it is not detached information. It is information that includes one's identity. And we see this happening quite clearly with Irenaeus of Lyon. He wrote his work against the heresies during a period of persecution and after a particularly brutal persecution of Christians within the Roman Empire. What he understood as uniting Christians across the empire were beliefs. Were those things that could be conveyed in information. And when he turned his attention to those he referred to as the so-called Gnostics, that is what he looked at. The information he was able to collect, to obtain, understanding and describing it as if it were of the exact same nature as the orthodoxy he was attempting to grow. Now, some are tempted to look at orthodoxy as one simple thing. However, this framework of getting people to agree upon things based upon information and belief is in many ways a way of merely hiding diversity. As orthodoxy grows and develops, the protected areas of information, usually referred to as doctrine and dogma, grow so that these remain off limits. At each ecumenical council, a new area was declared to be off limits for discussion and dispute. It did not always work, and occasionally there were reverses. But that was the point of the ecumenical councils, to decide some aspect of this unifying information so that it removes it from the arena of consideration. It has been decided. One of the most important aspects that needed to be decided and codified were the stories that could be told, and the nature of the characters in those stories. These are the sacred stories, stories told in Scripture. The Orthodox stories were limited to those collected in the New Testament, yet these are far from being one unified story. They actually show many of the elements that are involved in sacred stories. How even a story told about an historical figure with historical events involved is understood in different ways, and therefore the story is framed in different ways. One of Irenaeus' big objections to the heretics was the creation of new stories, because that opens the largest arena for exploration. If the characters in the stories can do very different things than they had done in previous stories, or if they become more symbolic, or are used to illustrate some other aspect, then the control over that information is lost. And furthermore, since that is the foundation of the unifying information, that is to say, the shared profession of belief, then it was indeed the most dangerous challenge to orthodoxy. Irenaeus spends a good deal of time trying to elaborate aspects of these stories and show their absurdity. That if these things are literally true, then they are silly. However, the writers of those stories would not have needed that lesson. It is a lesson Irenaeus could have used when looking at the scriptures he considered orthodox. Yet his arguments for the canonical gospels and their growing use was not enough. Nor was their imposition enough, because they have never been enough. They've never been satisfactory as being the whole of the story of Christ. And so, other stories have always been told. Some of these stories were about the nature of Christ, the nature of Jesus. We are familiar with the all man and all God definition that arose from one of these ecumenical councils. And that was to offer only one story where there had previously been different stories. And we can see this development of orthodoxy within the framework of attempting to tell one single story that is more and more complete. Or put another way, to place into that protected area of information and doctrine more and more aspects of the story. Earlier we briefly touched upon the fact that these stories are of fundamental importance, because these are the sources of all the rest of this unifying information, of these professed beliefs. So if the story were to change, that would be a problem. And when the story expands in a way in which there are different options, it also becomes a problem. And over time, you see a growth of the story, as people's understandings of the original story are added in and become a part of the doctrine, part of the dogma, and eventually part of that larger story. And as this continually grows, more and more of it needs to be protected. Yet, of course, people, always being curious, always wanting to bring their own understanding to bear, will always expand these things. So you get a growth of what is a part of orthodoxy and a growth of what is not a part of orthodoxy. Now we need to also be careful in accepting claims that beliefs and practices are based upon this story. The reverse is just as likely to be the case. We see this in early scripture, where different communities wrote from a different understanding of the story and included different elements from their particular understanding. And so the form and understanding of Scripture is itself shaped by the form and understanding of the community from which that Scripture grew. We must always bear in mind the quote from Benjamin Franklin, that it is good to be a reasonable being, for then one can come up with a reason for whatever it is one wanted to do anyway. As the orthodoxy formed and grew, the story it told grew more and more out of the social and political sphere. The issues it addressed became more and more abstract, or more specific. And the list of orthodox beliefs grew longer and longer. And fairly early on, we get to the absurd position where people do not know what it is that they believe. They are unaware that belonging to this religion means believing all of these things. If religion truly equaled belief, then how is that possible? In accepting that view, we are accepting an understanding that religion is information, that it can be abstract, detached from the individual followers. And while the notion of religion being information makes orthodoxy possible, it does not serve any other purpose. And as Gnostics, we really must challenge that view. For Gnosis is not something that can be abstract, removed from individuals. How can a Gnostic religion be abstract or removed from individuals? And yet if we hold the view that religion equals beliefs, we are holding that view. However, if we discard that view, since it is merely an approach to orthodoxy rather than an approach to religion, then the picture becomes much more complex, for even within orthodoxy, you have a great variety. Between two people with the same professed belief might have very different understandings of that belief. And indeed, that was the cause for the failure of the early creeds to screen out Gnostics. It is a matter of understanding. Also, between two followers of a religion, they might hold a different range of beliefs within the accepted beliefs, such as example earlier where someone might not be aware of what it was they believe by being a member of a religion. A very common example being two people who believe that the Bible is the Word of God. However, one of them hasn't read the whole thing through, and the other has read it through many times. From the informational perspective, there is no difference in this belief. However, the difference is obvious. To the one, what they believe to be the Word of God is vague. To the other, at least the contents and the information included in that book are known. And so what seemed to be a solution to differences ends up merely being a way of hiding differences. Two people in the same pew might pray to God, and one of them may be thinking of a very anthropomorphic God image. The other may be directed towards a mystical presence. And yet, on the surface, on the level of professed beliefs, there is no difference. The other large problem occurs when the protected areas of the story, that which has been established and set aside as doctrine or dogma, are challenged. There is a tendency to try to put as much as possible into that protected area, and we have seen the results of that. One puts scientific information into that protected area, and it is incorrect scientific information, then you have a problem. Also, if you place information into that protected area that is there merely to bolster a current social condition, and that social condition changes, you also have a problem. Whether this be slavery of the ancient or more recent variety, or gender, or sexual orientation. It is always a great struggle to even be able to address areas that have been placed in that field of doctrine or dogma. And so this approach and this model has very severe limitations. It is also only one approach, one model, and it arose from particular historical circumstances. In understanding that, and in understanding it, we can begin to develop an understanding of religion that might lead us away from insane religion, that might lead us away from that model and framework wherein which sane religion is an oxymoron, and towards a model and framework for sane religion. And we will begin to turn our attention towards that next time. Real spirituality is reality-oriented spirituality. It is practical. It is pragmatic. It begins with where you are now, it extends to your experience. Last time we talked about how important it is to know where you are at on your path. Because we are always beginning our spiritual path. We are always having to start from where we are. If we do not know where we are, how can we know where we are going? So let us begin by asking a very important question. What is I? Usually, this is phrased in the form of, who am I? But that is not what I mean. What I'm speaking of is, what is it that we mean when we think I, or me, myself? It is common for this to be an idea, that we have an idea of who we are, and so we have answers to questions about ourselves. They're ready made. Someone asks a question, do you like this? What do you think about that? We simply reach into this concept, this idea of ourselves, for the answer. We do not spend any time contemplating what the answer might be. There is no experience involved, and so there is no possibility for gnosis. There is only the idea of who one is. Just like any other image, you mistake it for that which it represents. You can become very mistaken indeed. And even if you were correct at one point, over time, you may become more and more incorrect. As human beings, we live, we grow, we change. Does the idea of ourselves live, grow, and change? We can try to keep up, to have a more and more accurate approximation of who we are as our idea of who we are. And in some aspects of ourselves and our lives, that is the best we can do. However, most of the time, we can do better. Instead of looking to a concept, to an idea, for the answer, we can look instead to ourselves. Or to phrase it another way, instead of looking to the what I am, we can look to the who I am. Instead of the object of a concept, of an idea, we can look into the subject, into the subjective. We can hold the question long enough for an answer to grow. This takes a little bit of time, and many people are unused to it. I've had people grow very uncomfortable waiting for an answer because I was also waiting for an answer. I also had people feel that I was avoiding the question when I was trying to live with the question long enough for there to be an answer. This points us deeper and deeper. When we try to see where we are, when we try to see what different elements comprise ourselves, we want the answers. We want to jump to the conclusion. But any answer we grasp, if it is not wrong in that moment, it will be wrong at some future moment. Instead, we hold on to the questions. We let the questions live. And if we live them out, then the answers have a deeper form. The simple questions, the answers are simple, and one might never know the difference. But for deeper questions, questions of meaning, questions of life, questions of ultimate identity, living them out is the only way to find any answer. For any answer given through any other means is detached from the question, and therefore cannot be an answer to that question. When we look at our ideas of ourselves, what we see is our identity, and our identities are generally quite defensive in nature. They define us to defend us. Self-defense is one of the most important jobs of that part of ourselves that we generally refer to as the ego. And identity is one of those main forms of defense. One should not try to destroy, disown, disavow the ego, for to be defenseless in the world is extraordinarily non-Gnostic in nature, and just plain crazy, unless you think the world is make-believe, and there are things in the world that can and will harm you. No matter how loving your intentions may be towards an oncoming train, if you don't get off the tracks, the end result is inevitable. Self-defense is required. And that is just one of the important functions of the ego. Problem is, when the Generalissimo conducts a military junta and is in control of everything. And that is the general state, the psychology of most human beings. Their self-defensiveness is in charge of everything. And this ends up being sort of odd, unbalancing, where the bodyguard is the only one there, guarding no one, and instead is merely guarding an idea or a concept. And this takes one into very dangerous ground, because any idea or concept one is defensive of can become not only a trigger for hostility, but a trigger for violence. If we can begin to look at our identity as an idea, as a concept, as at best an approximation, as merely our momentary best understanding of ourselves then we can begin to separate out and begin to experience these different elements within ourselves. For we are vast, we are complex, we are not simply one thing, not simply our thoughts or ideas, not simply our flesh. We are all of this and so much more. Rather than being defensive against all things, even against our own experiences of ourselves, rather than keeping the door always closed, the guard always posted and denying all access, let us open the door. Let us begin to examine, begin to see, what is it I is? And behind that, the deeper sense of who I am. May you have many blessings on your journey. This podcast, please send your questions, comments, or suggestions to RevTroy@gnosis.org. Thank you.
Resources on Gnosticism, visit the Gnosis Archive at Gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.